ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves. We stood tall and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
We launched this campaign because no one was clearly and authentically talking about issues like the corrupting role of money in politics, like the disturbing human rights violations being committed by ICE, by the fact that no one was giving voice to the idea and the notion that an entire generation is graduating with crippling loads of student loan debt, a ticking time bomb for our economy. No one was talking about these issues, and when no one talks about them, we have the duty to stand up for what is right.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, elected to the U.S. House of Representatives on the Democratic ticket in 2018. She is one of a new breed of left-wing politicians who have been trying to change the Democratic Party. Hi, I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. In this, the second part of our series, tracing the story of radical and left-wing politics in America. So why are we looking at this now, when the right in US politics seems to be dominating? With Donald Trump's second term, and the Republicans controlling both houses of Congress. Have we missed a shift to the left in the Democratic Party? Like Bernie Sanders, a socialist, who almost gained the Democratic nomination in 2016, and whose influence seems to be growing. Or the election last week in the New York mayoral race of Zohran Mamdani, an openly Democratic socialist as New York mayor. Could there be a resurgence in left-wing ideas in American politics? In part one, we left the story in the 1930s, the Depression years, when the socialist and communist parties of America were expanding in number and influence, and even finding their policies reflected in Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal.
I see one third of a nation ill housed, ill clad, ill nourished. But it is not in despair that I paint that picture for you. I paint it for you in hope, because the nation, seeing and understanding the injustice of it, proposes to paint it out. I see a United States which can demonstrate that under democratic methods of government, national wealth can be translated into a spreading volume of human comfort hitherto unknown, and the lowest standard of living can be raised far above the level of mere subsistence.
Franklin Roosevelt made it very clear that he was trying to save capitalism, that he wanted to reform capitalism enough so it would be a healthier system, a system that would serve the ordinary person better.
Michael Kazin, professor of history at Georgetown University and co-editor of American Dissent magazine.
And also the trade union movement, labor union movement, grew tremendously during the time Roosevelt was in power. Went from 3 million members in 1933 to 15 million members in 1945. And it was not demanding socialism either. It was demanding better wages, union recognition, a better grievance procedure on the job, lower hours, you know, reforms, in other words, not radicalism. And also the New Deal was anchored by Southern whites in the Democratic Party who really hadn't changed their racial views very much since slavery. So it could not be a radical party in the way radicals would have wanted it to be. But it made important reforms and made America a better place, and that was enough for most people.
And I'm wondering whether that actually cemented many white working class people to the Democratic Party.
Well, yes, definitely. Well, the Southern whites had already been cemented to the Democratic Party because it was the party that had opposed Reconstruction and the party that had allowed Southern whites to disenfranchise black voters. But also the Northern whites, including many recent immigrants who had not voted much before, it did become the white working class party in effect, which is why it became the majority party, because the majority of Americans were white and were without college education, so without even without a high school education at that time. It was definitely a party which was very much buoyed by the support of unions and by the growth of unions. So it became something of a labor party, though much less ideologically class conscious than the Labor Party in Australia and socialist parties in other countries were. But it was, again, a hybrid. And without these Southern whites who wanted help from the government but didn't want anything to do with racial equality or civil rights laws, the New Deal would have had a very hard time getting many laws passed. And that's why Franklin Roosevelt didn't push for civil rights, because he understood that he needed those Southern white votes.
During the 1930s, the Soviet Union was the beacon of hope for many communists and even socialists in the United States.
United forever in friendship and labor, our mighty republics will ever endure. The great Soviet Union will live through the ages, the dream of a people, their fortress secure.
The strength and then the Achilles heel of the communist left was always its relationship with the Soviet Union.
Christopher Phelps, one of the authors of Radicals in America.
In the context of the Great Depression, the Soviet example could be pointed to. They have a 5-year plan. They have no unemployment. They are industrializing at a headlong pace. Meanwhile, world capitalism is flat on its back. And furthermore, the Soviet Union is a bulwark against Nazism. Let's have a grand popular front of liberals and leftists that'll come together and stop this. But a whole series of events complicates this. The Moscow trials of 1936 to 1938, in which the whole old Bolshevik leadership of the Soviet Union is wiped out so that Stalin can consolidate personal power. The 1939 Nazi-Soviet pact between Hitler and Stalin that allows Hitler to focus on attacking France and Britain. And then in the post-war period, the Cold War, which of course has two sides. Stalin is involved and so is Truman. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was president from 1933 to 1945 and was immensely popular and a left liberal who had a different attitude toward the Soviet Union. He had restored diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union. He had cooperated with the Soviet Union during the Grand Alliance of the Second World War. And Truman, his vice president, who takes office when Roosevelt dies, has a whole different set of instincts. He's a much more conservative Democrat and a much more regional Missouri politician, and he is for a much firmer line with the Soviet Union, and things go bad.
The average American can do very little insofar as digging communist espionage agents out of our government is concerned. They must depend upon those of us whom they send down here to man the watchtowers of the nation.
The post-war years were extremely challenging and difficult ones for American radicals. They'd come out of the 30s and the great spirit of the marches and the sit-downs and so forth, and they had thrown themselves into the struggle against fascism, and they had the view in 1945, 46, 47 that now fascism's defeated. Now we can have a world of social justice. Now we can go on to social democracy, if not something even more radical. But the headwinds are so powerful coming of the Cold War that they end up more marginal by 1953 than ever. And of course, a key component of that is what we call McCarthyism, but was actually a very broad consensus of the American political establishment, begun under Harry S. Truman and the Democrats, who adopted a security oath for federal employees, but then carried to an extreme by Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin and his kind in the House Un-American Activities Committee, too, who were of the view that liberals are in bed with communists. exacted a very high toll. You would lose your job, your income, your friends. It was extremely difficult to be an openly declared communist and not suffer adverse consequences. But that was true also of democratic radicals who were critical of Stalinism, as they called it. They suffered just as much. Teachers driven from their jobs, radio and television people and movie people driven from their jobs. And, you know, by 1955, the American left was virtually a spent force.
This is Rear Vision on RN. I'm Annabelle Quince. This is the second part of our series tracing the history of the radical left in American politics. Despite being all but destroyed by Joe McCarthy, within a decade the left in America had re-emerged, this time led by a new generation of radicals who were very different from the socialists and communists of the 1930s.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream.
I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart.
This is the mystery, is how, given this immense attack on the left in the McCarthy period, which seemingly finished off the left of the 30s generation, how then did so quickly a left regenerate itself? And how do you get the what we now think of as the radical 60s coming off of the McCarthyist 50s? And the key really is the civil rights movement, an independent civil rights movement. Under the period in which the Communist Party led the left, the cause of racial equality had been championed by it, and it had such a kind of clout and power that it could, in many cases, through its front organizations, dominate those sorts of efforts. But the independent civil rights movement, what we think of as a black freedom movement, beginning with the Montgomery bus boycott of 55-56 that brought Martin Luther King to fame, begun by Rosa Parks, onward, is black-led, independently black-led. And that independence is part of it. But as African Americans in the age of television confront police dogs and fire hoses, and as a new generation of African American youth in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the sit-in movements of early 1960s begins to take action, Northern youth begin to solidarize with that. It's a generation, and of course it's the baby boom. There are more youth than ever going to universities. And youth are always the lifeblood of the left. It's always young people who are willing to take risks, who don't realize the world has always been this way and always will be, the kind of cynicism and attitude that you get with age, and are daring to dream, and in fact are insistent on dreaming. And furthermore, that generation had been instilled with the idea that the United States is the free world, that this is a democracy, that, and they took it to heart. And then when they see what's happening in Mississippi and Alabama, and they feel betrayed, it's a lie, and they don't want to let it be a lie. They want to insist on it being made a reality. So there's a kind of Cold War moralism that ironically feeds 60s radicalism. So there are many tributaries causing a regeneration of radicalism before the Vietnam War, which of course is what blows things wide open.
We pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves. Not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right. If a free society cannot help the many who are poor. It cannot save the few who are rich.
What we think of as the radical 60s was also a mature moment for American liberalism, first under Kennedy and then under Johnson. And both of them saw themselves as social liberals. Kennedy, of course, launched the civil rights legislation, which after his death, Johnson carried through on. Johnson, always a competitive type, wanted to outdo Kennedy. And the war on poverty and his social agenda, which was also an attempt to emulate the prior example of Roosevelt, was his work. And so all of this is interactive. The left pushing the Democrats and the Democrats partly taking the lead. And there's a lot of tension in that period. It might seem on the surface like this is all in cooperation. But in fact, there's tremendous tension between the frontline civil rights activists and the Kennedy administration, which they view as very conservative and very slow moving.
We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal treatment. We believe that all men have certain unalienable rights, yet many Americans do not enjoy those rights. We believe that all men are entitled to the blessings of liberty, yet millions are being deprived of those blessings, not because of their own failures, but because of the color of their skin.
And then in the Johnson era, when Johnson escalates the Vietnam War in 1965, the left very quickly comes to have a different view of the Vietnam War. They don't see it as about stopping communism. They see it as about the United States imposing its will on a third world country that wants to make different choices and have a national development of its own. In some ways, American liberalism is going farther than ever before, and part of that is fueled by left-wing pressure and inspiration. And yet the left is often in strident opposition to liberalism and to the administrations of Kennedy and Johnson.
In the 1960s is when civil rights laws passed, the Voting Rights Act is passed, the beginning of affirmative action on the job and in education, not just for African Americans, but also for what we then called Hispanic Americans and Asian Americans and women too. And again, this happened after a large radical movement for Black equality was formed, people like Martin Luther King Jr. Leading it. And also they transformed the Democratic Party. I mean, there was a candidate who ran for president in 1972, George McGovern, who was actually a labor historian. And his platform was far, far more radical than anything the Democratic Party had ever stood for. It was close to a platform that a strong social democratic party in Europe might have stood for. And he would not have been nominated by the Democratic Party if a lot of new leftists had not entered the Democratic Party and run for delegates, primaries, and caucuses to get enough strength to get him nominated in a Democratic convention that year. Now, he didn't win election, but the Democratic Party has been a different party since that point. And you see that this year as well. In the midterm elections, you have avowed socialists who are getting elected to Congress as Democrats.
But the 1960s New Left hit a roadblock in the early 1970s.
The New Left, which in giving new clout to students and African Americans in the strategic thinking and the social movements, broadly speaking, which proliferated in the 60s, that's when we get the women's movement, it's when we get the gay and lesbian movement, it's when you get the environmental movement. That new left has a crisis around 1973, 1974. And the reason for that crisis is severalfold. For one thing, there's a downturn in the economy. And much of the 60s left, unlike the 30s left, had enjoyed prosperity. And when there's prosperity in a full employment economy and you're a student, there's not very much risk involved in militant activity because there's likely to be a job at the other end anyway. But there's a new attitude about focusing on studies, about focusing on careerism. And there's a reason why the 70s gets called a me decade. There's a turn inward. And a second reason is simply the winding down of the Vietnam War. The draft stops. They stop conscripting youth. And then by 75, the war is actually over. And that takes the wind out of the sails of the anti-war movement. And then there's the controversy over the left's own activity. A good part of the leadership of the new left in the late 60s had come to conceive of itself as revolutionary, and that could take all kinds of different meanings, from seeking a whole transformation of the society in a complex way to violence and destruction as a tactic. The Weathermen and other sorts of groups undertake bombings of banks and corporate offices and the Pentagon, and one in a Capitol bathroom stall, for example. The effect is to take the greatest peace movement in American history and make it seem controversial, make it seem much more risky. So there's a self-defeating aspect to that late New Left history that needs to be confronted, as well as those objective circumstances that are making it harder for the left to organize.
Well, I think it didn't disappear so much as fragment. There was still a radical movement, still a left movement in the United States through the 70s, 80s, 90s, into this century. But it wasn't a unified movement. You couldn't talk about a new left. You couldn't talk about a new socialist movement or a new communist movement, of course. There was a feminist movement, a gay and lesbian movement. But these movements did not find common cause for the most part. People took refuge in sort of proud identities as women or as gay people, or sometimes both, but or as African Americans or as Latinos or as Asian Americans and so forth. And so there was no leadership to bring them together. There was no sense of a shared purpose as there had been earlier, whether to oppose the Vietnam War or support black equality. Both those causes have been won. So different groups pursued their own interests, their own demands. And so they were not as visible as part of a radical movement than they had been when those fragments really began to be formed in the 1950s, 1960s. But I do think it's important to emphasize that gains continue to be made.
The 80s had a much larger left than gets remembered, the Reagan years. There was a massive Central America solidarity movement. There was a huge anti-nuclear movement in response to Reagan's activities deploying intermediate nuclear weapons in Europe and calling for a nuclear freeze. And there was a left-wing democratic insurgency led by Jesse Jackson, the civil rights leader, called the Rainbow Coalition, and was trying to fuse all of the different left-wing concerns together into a coherent force and retake the Democratic Party. The 90s is different. The end of the Soviet Union created a notion of the end of socialism, and that combined with the Democratic Party's leadership under Bill Clinton and the Democratic Leadership Council, which was a very pro-corporate wing of the Democratic Party, meant there was kind of political context in which the left was on the margins again.
When do we see it starting to reemerge? Is it with Occupy Wall Street?
Well, the left, since the 90s, has had a sort of surge and collapse of history. There's a great surge around 1999 with the Battle of Seattle and then the anti-globalization, as it was called in the media, although all of which collapses with the Iraq War, with 9/11 and the Iraq War. So you have these surges, then these collapses. By the end of the Bush administration, there's momentum growing again, and yes, you get Occupy Wall Street with the 2008 financial crisis. And then you get some more collapse during the Obama administration, actually, of the activist and movement building left. But it is interesting that something has happened in our time, which is that we now have the reemergence of a conscious left wing inside the Democratic Party, and especially a flourishing of socialist consciousness among youth. And that probably does date to Occupy Wall Street. That probably is the line of continuity to Bernie Sanders.
What does it mean to be a socialist?
I think for a start, it means that you have a vision that's very different from status quo politicians have. But also, what socialism means for me is very similar to what it meant for Eugene Debs. And it really means nothing more than democracy.
Radicals don't measure themselves by conventional political criteria of success. So Bernie Sanders didn't get elected president of the United States. He didn't even become the nominee of the Democratic Party. What he did do is change the conversation nationally and within the Democratic Party. In the 1990s, it was seen as completely irresponsible to talk about single-payer health care, which was the Canadian-style health insurance system. Bill Clinton and Hillary Rodham Clinton, when they launched a health care initiative in his first year in office in 1993, didn't even put it on the table. It was seen as lunatic leftism. That vision, which Bernie has called Medicare for All, is now popularized so that more Democrats are turning and advocating for that. They've seen that Obamacare, which was a kind of halfway measure, hasn't ended the conversation, hasn't succeeded in successfully insuring all Americans. Medicare for All is now becoming likely to become a platform of the Democratic Party, whether or not Bernie is the nominee. And that's what radicalism does. Radicalism pushes the envelope so that conventional politics has to open up, so that slavery is abolished, so that women get the right to vote, so that African Americans have civil rights, so that possibly one day Americans will all have health care.
If you want any power at all in government, you have to be part of one of the major parties. And when you have the kind of polarization in which almost every conservative, self-described conservative now votes Republican and every self-described liberal or progressive votes for Democrats, there is room for out-and-out leftists, even socialists, in the Democratic Party, as I mentioned before. You can get elected as a socialist. And Bernie Sanders came about 3 million votes in the 2016 campaign from getting the nomination, taking the nomination away from Hillary Clinton. So it's both a necessity and I think in some ways a virtue, I think, for leftists to be in the Democratic Party. They won't get everything they want, but the more leftists who join the Democratic Party, more leftists who run for office in the Democratic Party, the more social movements on the left see themselves fighting for influence and power in the Democratic Party, the more they'll push the Democratic Party to the left. That happened with the conservative movement in the Republican Party, too. And I see no reason why that same kind of thing can't happen in the Democratic Party. In fact, it's already happening.
Broadly, the Democratic Party is turning away from the neoliberalism of the Clinton wing that so long defined Democratic Party politics. And there's a new generation coming to the fore that's much more willing to be full-throated liberals in the old sense of the term, in the kind of New Deal sense of the term. And then also what's interesting is that we have the reemergence of a real socialist left, especially among youth and young intellectuals and young organizers who are not just looking for liberalism. They think the entire society has to be changed. Workplaces have to be democratic. Incomes and wealth have to be made egalitarian. And they want not just some Band-Aids. They want a radical transformation. So there's going to be a conversation between the strengthened liberal wing of the Democratic Party and the even further left who call themselves socialists. No one knows where it's going to lead, but it's a more convinced left than we've seen in a good long while.
And that's a conversation that is only likely to grow louder. My guests in this program, Christopher Phelps, co-author of Radicals in America. Robin Archer, author of Why There Is No Labour Party in the United States. And Michael Kazin, professor of history at Georgetown University. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.